time I told you that there's a category of lessons which are based on speech acts. The category of hodor, declaration. There are three types of blessings which are unified by the fact that they are on declarations of fact, acknowledgments of fact, and then express a response to those facts, an attitude in response to the facts. The three categories were thanksgiving, praise, and petition. Each of those is based on a fact and then expresses a response to the fact. So thanksgiving is based on recognition of the fact that I have received the benefit, and then there's my attitude or emotion of gratefulness as a response. Praise is based on the fact that the item is truly great in some respect or other, and the response is one of awe. Petition is based on the fact that I need X and he has X, and my response to it is to ask for it rather than, as we said last time, steal it or do something else. So that's one category of blessings. Then there are blessings before you perform a commandment and blessings on using something for your benefit from the world. Blessing before performing the commandments in part reflect the fact that you only satisfy a commandment if, when you do the action, you intend that it should satisfy the requirements of the commandment. Now, this idea is very often misunderstood, so let me make as clear as I can what I mean. A person is doing an action. This action happens to fulfill a law. That's not enough to say that the person has done the mitzvah. For example, he might be unaware that he's fulfilling the law. He looks at his watch and he says, 10:30. Well, it's too late for Shema. But I do want to practice my Hebrew reading. And he takes out the Shema paragraph and he reads through the paragraph. Then he looks again at his watch and says, what? 10:30? It's not 10:30, it's 8:30. And 8:30 isn't time for the Shema. He hasn't done it. He has to go back and do it again. Because he didn't intend, when he said the words, that they should fulfill the mitzvah of saying the Shema. On the other hand, all you need is intention. Intention is not motivation. We're not talking about your goal or your purpose in acting. A person may be, indeed, practicing his pronunciation. But he may say, since I've decided to practice my pronunciation at 8:30, so it is time for the Shema, I also want this to count for the mitzvah of Shema. It's an intention rather than the purpose or motivation. This leaves open the possibility that a person can do mitzvos for a selfish motivation and still satisfy the mitzvah. He only has to recognize that it's an obligation and intend that it be satisfied. That's enough. So, when you come to do a mitzvah, if you make a blessing beforehand, that is likely to express your intention that it should fulfill the mitzvah, should fulfill the mitzvah, and thereby it will fulfill it. It's a way of focusing your consciousness momentarily on that intention. Now, in the blessing it says, Asher kidishanu mitzvah so etzivon, who has sanctified us by his commandments and commanded us to do X, Y, Z. What does sanctifying us by his commandments refer to? There are at least two different possibilities. It could mean that he sanctified us by giving us the commandments, by addressing us and assigning the commandments to us. And or it could mean that when we perform the commandment and do so with at least that minimal intention that the commandment be satisfied, that the performance sanctifies us. The words will bear either interpretation. And I think they're both true. The very fact that he assigned the Torah to us, set us apart from other nations, and now it's symptomatic of and in part causes its interaction, the fact that we have a special status, the status that can be described in part as sanctity. But then, having addressed the commandments to us, each time a commandment is performed, that realizes a certain holiness potential in a person, the performance gives it that shot of holiness. So when we say the bracha, the blessing, both things should be in mind. Our inherent status is being addressed by the Torah, and also the opportunity for kedusha, for sanctity, when we perform the mitzvah. The deep problem with blessings is the word Baruch. The very first word. What does Baruch mean? The commentators offer three possibilities. Baruch in some contexts means praise. Levarech can mean to praise. That's kind of distant from the inherent meaning of the root. Blessing in Hebrew usually means an increase on a pre-existing basis. Let me link it up for a moment to English. What does blessing mean in English? That's a blessing. I mean, blessing in English means something that is truly good. We talk about blessings in disguise. It means when it happened, I was disinclined. But I discovered later that it was really good. A blessing is something which is really good, something that I really need, not something that I might happen to want. Now, livareich then would mean to give someone something that he really needs. Provide for someone something that he really needs. Boruch is the passive of that root. So literally, Boruch ought to mean blessed, which is the way it's translated in most translations, and blessed ought to mean recipient of blessing. One who has received a blessing from something or someone else. Now, if you're going to say that about God, it's going to be very peculiar. In what way can God receive something good? To receive a kind of expansion of the good that he has. It's going to be a very difficult idea. Although the Nefesh HaKayim actually does think that. Another way out is to take the word Baruch the other way and to explain it to mean source of blessing. So the Rashba and the Ein Yaakov says. Trouble there will be the grammar. How can a passive construction like Baruch mean source of blessing? Or to mean recipient of blessing? So here's how it works. My daughters, who are experts in Hebrew grammar, it's one of the subjects that Beis Yaakov teaches to excellence, and boys never get it, explained to me that Baruch can be parallel to Rachum and Chanun. Rachum means merciful. Chanun means gracious. Merciful means the one who provides mercy. I will ask that Rachum and Chanun, the first vowel is a pasach, and in Baruch it's a comment. That's true, but there's a grammatical rule that before a resh, a pasach changes into a comment. So it really could be in grammar Baruch instead of Baruch. And it could be the source of blessing. That's why the Rashba and the Ein Yaakov says what he says. Then it's obvious. God is the source of blessing to us. He provides us a blessing. But Nefesh HaChaim could be right also. This is roughly what he says, translated into my terminology. When we talk about God, we talk about God as will. That's what of God we can speak about. We've mentioned this a number of times. You know, a will is oriented towards a purpose. So God is presented to us as will oriented to a purpose. Anything which moves that purpose forward, if the creation is set up in such a way that by my actions I can move the creation forward towards that purpose, will be good for that will. So if God presents himself to me, so to speak, as a will, with a purpose, and he creates the world in such a way that accomplishing that purpose is in part dependent upon me, then my actions can in fact present him with good. Now, what is his purpose? His purpose is to do good for me. So that what my actions do is to make it possible for him to give me good. And that's what he wants. He wants to give me good. That means that both meanings are true. That he's a recipient of blessing and that he's a source of blessing. And it means that our relationship with God is a relationship of mutual blessing. That's what the word Baruch encapsulates. When one says the word Baruch, the idea, if you take a moment to think, the idea is that I stand in this relationship of mutual blessing with God. He wants to do good for me, and the good he wants to do for me depends upon my acting in such a way as to be qualified for it, so that when I do that, I'm enabling him to do what he wants to do for me. Now that's the idea that accompanies every blessing. You with me so far? Okay, so now we've spoken about the constants. Constants is blessings based on acknowledgement. We've spoken about the blessings for commandments. Here are the blessings for pleasure. If you read what the Talmud says, simply, it sounds like this. There's an orange. Now, this fellow over here is going to eat that orange. I said, you're going to eat it. Don't worry. When he eats that orange, he is destroying it for his own pleasure, for his own benefit. Okay, but that orange belongs to God. So, says the Talmud, a person who makes who eats without making a blessing, is it that he stole it? One makes a blessing in order to avoid the crime of stealing the orange that doesn't belong to the person. That's if you read the statement of the Gemara simplistically, without a mistake. But there are a number of difficulties with this way of reading it. First of all, non-Jews don't have to make blessings. And they're just as required not to steal as anybody else. Secondly, systematic blessings for food and drink only came into existence maybe 2,300 years ago, 2,400 years ago, and more than 1,000 years of Jewish history before that, where blessings weren't made. Maybe you say they had the right attitudes, but blessings certainly weren't made. They didn't exist. Thirdly, Rabbi Eger asks the following tricky question. A person who suffers a loss, when a family member dies, let's say, a parent, and he has the responsibility of arranging for the funeral, is relieved of all positive commandments. He doesn't put on tefillin, he doesn't bench, he doesn't wash his hands before he eats, doesn't study Torah, doesn't pray, doesn't put on tefillin. Because he has a mitzvah that has to be done, and that mitzvah takes precedence over other mitzvahs that might interrupt. But he's not allowed to perform any crimes. Just because he has the responsibility of bearing a parent, he can't steal. So now, if the law was, the orange doesn't belong to you, and if you eat it, you're stealing it. Making the blessing is only a means whereby to take off, to get, as I said, to get permission to eat it, and by getting permission to eat it, you then are not stealing it. So if so, then someone who suffers a loss should definitely make blessings. Because if he eats without making blessings, he's stealing. And he's not allowed to steal. But the law is that he doesn't have to make blessings and he's allowed to eat. How can that be? So the Kiva Eger says that the truth is that the situation is upside down. The truth is that the rabbis made a rule of making a blessing before you eat for their own purposes. For the purposes of raising your consciousness as to what you're doing when you're eating. And now if you eat without fulfilling the rabbinic requirement, it's as if you're stealing. The blessing isn't to remove the problem of stealing. The creation of the blessing then creates the problem of stealing. If you eat it without the blessing, you're stealing. Therefore, since the foundation of the institution is the positive commandment of making blessings, and a person who suffers a loss that has no positive responsibilities, doesn't have to do any positive commandments, so he doesn't have to do the blessing. He doesn't have to do the blessing. The problem is stealing. It's not a problem. Okay?
And why didn't it hit the
Because, I'll tell you a story which maybe will illustrate the point well. When I used to teach at the Meir Yerushalayim, there was a young woman there. She had finished Yale. She came in for a few months. And she said to me after a couple of months, she said, I'm making blessings because everybody else is making blessings, but I'm embarrassed. I don't believe in it, and I feel like a hypocrite. What should I do? I said, you can't build Torah observance on a foundation of hypocrisy. Stop making blessings until you feel comfortable doing it. That's what I told her. Well, some of my colleagues found out about this. I get some flack. So I began to wonder. I mean, my colleagues are intelligent people, and I made a mistake. The sanctity and the blessing will affect the soul, something like that. So I spoke to another colleague, and he said he had gone to one of the greatest decisors of the century, with a similar question, and the answer he got was, the words the person is saying are not a blessing. Blessing is not syllables. A blessing is a statement of intention. The fact that the person recites the right sounds without the intention is not a blessing. Of course, if it's not a question of should she make blessings until she believes in it, then not blessing. She's incapable of making a blessing. So I told this to my Rebbe, and my Rebbe said, agreed, and he said, it was a good decision, but he said, had she asked him, he would have said, okay, don't make blessings, you don't believe in it, but before you eat, pause for a moment. He calls it the pause that humanizes. Don't eat like an animal. There's more to you than a cow. Think for a moment. Think who you are. Think where you are in life. Think what you want to do in life. Think what the food is supposed to mean. And then eat like a human being. Don't eat like an animal. Now, I think that the Rebbe here was indicating something which I try to incorporate in my general philosophy. A human action, as I've told you many times, a human action is not the motion of a body. A human action is the external expression of a mind. A mind with a philosophy, a mind with a set of values, a mind with goals, a mind with a sense of its own identity. What one does mindlessly, in a way, is not fully human. The only exception is where you program yourself to do something mindlessly because it's more efficient to do it mindlessly, like a surgeon making surgery. But what you do mindlessly, if your mind is really offline, then as a human being, you're not really there. So there's a tremendous effort in Jewish practice to keep the mind online, to make the actions as fully human as possible. Why? Because God wants to be incorporated into every aspect of life. That's how you're connected to God. That's how your relationship with God is as full as possible. This, we said once, is the reason why there's it's valuable to study the reasons of the commandments, because the more reasons you understand, the more of your mind is involved in the performance of the mitzvah. So the blessing is a way of focusing your mind on the act of eating. What is it? Where did the food come from? What is it supposed to do for me? What does it mean? Yes, I have a body that's very similar to animal bodies. So what does that mean for my identity? How is it integrated into my identity? I bless God as the one who is the source of the food to bring my whole religious identity online when I eat. That's how I understand the motivation for making the blessing, for creating the blessings in the first place. Once you do that, if someone eats without that, then in a way, he's eating like an animal. He's eating like an animal. The implication of the Gemara is that that isn't the way God wanted us to eat. It wasn't for that he gave food to human beings. Okay?
Okay.
Yeah.
What you just said, this is very important in the overall aspect of observing Judaism. There's so many applications, at least it seems to be. I know that very religious people have to follow certain things that they are rabbis now. In Jerusalem, for example. Something that they are religious. does see a problem with rabbis trying to constrain people in following the things that they tell them to do, not to have a computer, to be dressed a certain way, etc., etc. So what happens on one side, they sort of suppress the individuality, right, the individuality. So it's like they want to help them to stay within their framework. At the same time, whether they like it or not, they suppress their individuality in respect that they cannot express their own attitude towards their observer. I'm not sure if I'm clear on what I'm saying, but you know what I mean. So where and how you can find the balance?
Well, I don't know if I can say in words any formula that will be useful to tell you.
Is it a problem?
It is a problem. It is a problem. But I think it's a problem of all of us. I don't think it's a problem only here. I want to make two remarks. First of all, if you're going to play chess or football, there are rules of the game. And if my individualism would require that I take the knight and move it three spaces straight forward and take off your queen, you're going to tell me that I can't do that. I said, but my individualism leads me straight forward. I don't make L turns. It's just not me. It's not my style. You know. Well, then don't play chess. That's what chess is played. The laws of grammar in English, and the laws of semantics in English means the vast, vast majority of combinations of words are just out. Why are they out? Because when you use them, no one will know what you mean. So if you want to communicate to other people, they're out. That's the way English is played. So is that restricting your individualism? Sure. No question about it. Noam Chomsky had a wonderful example when he was doing this in the 60s. Of how you can have a grammatical sentence that's totally meaningless. Colorless green ideas sleep furiously. Now, it may suppress your individualism to tell you not to use that sentence, but if you want to express your individualism, use the sentence, no one will be able to understand you. Indeed, I would say there's nothing there to understand because the words don't express anything. So every activity in life, every meaningful activity, every significant activity is based on a set of rules, and the rules usually rule out the vast majority of things that you could do. So they're restrictive. You ever play in an orchestra? You're the performer. You're the musician. Everything is dictated. Everything. All the notes, all the dynamics. Then there's the conductor up there, that dictator, who tells you exactly how you have to play everything. And people compete for positions in orchestras. I don't think they're masochists. Not all of them, anyway. And then I find it odd. I find it odd that people are worried about conformity in dress. My guess is that the vast majority of people who are worried about this, if you would ask them what they think the significance of dress is, should you judge someone by the way he dresses? Should your dress be taken as an expression of your identity? Should it be indicative of your deepest philosophy and values? I'm sure they would say no. No, clothes are just the cloth I use to cover my body. Sure, you should talk to me. You should interact with me to find out what kind of person I am, not judge me by my dress. If so, then why would it be important if a group of people all had the same dress? That's not who they are, that's not what they are, that's what they believe in. That's not their values. That's just the cloth they use to cover the body. And indeed, one of the reasons for uniforms is that there shouldn't be any emphasis on dress. If everybody's wearing the same, nobody talks about the other guy's suit, or the other guy's hat, or the other guy's shoes, because they all look the same. In schools especially, this is very important. Because otherwise, dare I say it, especially among girls, but also among boys, a lot of time and interest is spent on how the other person looks and competition and buying clothes. Is that what you want a child to be occupied with? Is that what you want a child's consciousness to be taken up with? I think it's a waste of time. So if you have a uniform, you avoid all of that. So I'm surprised that people are worried that here's a group of people, all of them dressed the same. I think this means dress is reduced. It just becomes a non-issue. If you talk about conformity in certain aspects of more significant practice, so there indeed, it will suppress certain types of individuality. And the result of it will be that if a person feels he cannot express himself adequately in this group, he'll move to another group. There are lots of groups, even within what are called Haredi Judaism. Some do have computers and some don't. So if he really feels that he has a need to have a computer, he can move to another Haredi group. So, and the populations are fluid quite constantly. I have two children who are not Hasidic. I won't say that it wasn't painful, but I'm very proud of them. I'm very proud of what they are and what they're doing. So I said, you know, if you're going to move, I'm moving that way. I'll live with it. Rabbi Samet, who's the Mashkiach here, has three Hasidic sons. Can you imagine a tragedy bigger than that? He's not Hasidic. Three of his sons became Hasidic. Ah, end of the world. Poor Menashe here is dying. Shall I wish you that? No. Too cruel. So there is room for a certain variety. A certain variety. Of course, if a person feels that the most important thing to do on Saturday is play golf, then he's going to join some other group. He's not going to have membership in a political group. So I think it's a matter of how much of your individualism can be expressed within the group. Now, if you think of the variety of roles that religious people play, you have rabbis, and you have businessmen, and you have politicians, and you have scientists, and you have social workers, and all different kinds of people, all of whom are Haredi. So I would say there's considerable amount of variation within the Haredi world for a person's individuality. I came here in 1964, and my Rebbe was here, and he introduced me to a family in Neshar, deepest, darkest Neshar, with the stripes, coats, the whole thing. The father was telling me he had trouble with a 14-year-old son, some kind of neurosis. So I said, what do you do about it? He said, I took him to a psychologist. I said, what? You took him to a psychologist? He said, yeah, I went to the Rebbe, and we tried certain things, and then he felt that that's what he needed, so we took him to a psychologist. That was my first shocking experience, coming in from the outside, that the stereotypes that this is a sealed group with no connection is simply a mistake. They have their preferences, they have their priorities, they have their first line of defense, the second line of defense, but they're not as uniform as they appear until you get to know them personally.
So it's only a problem if people choose to stay within the group which rules they don't want to follow.
Yeah, that's true. Then that can be difficult to them and for the people around them. But that's true with any group. You know, if you have a kid who's playing football and he decides he wants to keep smoking, it's going to be a problem. It's going to be a problem for the team, a problem for the coach, and a problem for the kid. That's the way it is. I remember when I did sports in high school and college, and you know, the guy sweating over kicking the smoking habit for the season and worrying about that. Nope. That's the way it is. Okay. Now, that's basically the end of the Derech Hashem. But as I have mentioned to you a number of times, behind that is a thing called Essay on Fundamentals. And the last section of it is a short section called the Oral Torah. And I want to try to go through as much of that today and tomorrow as I can, because I think the points here are absolutely fundamental. Absolutely fundamental importance. And people try to deal with these issues, but I find often that the way they deal with it isn't organized and it doesn't hit the essential points. And I mentioned to some of you, the translation here, I think, is not quite right. He takes one word and mistranslates it systematically. So I'll do my own translation for you. I will try to draw the morals from it. This is in the back of your editions as well. Now, in my edition, 394, I have the newer edition. The older editions, that's the end of his. So what's going on with him? Yeah. Original. Mega beam. That's what all these editions say.
Oh, my
watch. Yeah, okay. Very good.
You pay for that.
All right. Gold. The master, blessed be he, did not want to write the Torah with sufficient clarity that it would not require a commentary. Explanation. Page. Explanation. But rather, on the contrary, wrote very many matters completely stumim in Hebrew means shut up. Shut up in a way that they're impenetrable. You can't see them. You can't observe them. So that it would be impossible for any person in the world to arrive at their true intention. Now the crucial word here is intention. The Catholic translates meaning, but I think that's a mistake. It's not mashma'ut in Hebrew, it's kavanah. No human being can arrive at the intention of these words without their being transmitted an explanation by a tradition that comes from God himself, from the author. For he is the author of these things. For example, the mitzvah of tefillin, or mezuzah, and similar mitzvahs, where you have a verse that commands them, but there's no clarification in the written Torah of what they mean, what you're supposed to do. The Torah says, bind these words for a sign on your hand or your arm. You cannot bind words on your arm. Words are abstract. How are you supposed to carry out this command? Write the words on your doorpost. Now that you could do. You could actually take a thick pen and ink and write them on the doorpost. But that's not clear that that's what the Torah intends you to do. I suppose the doorpost is marble, which you can't write it. So rather, with an intention, God intentionally hid the true intention of these words, for reasons that are known to him. And all those things that are hidden in the written, God transmitted to Moses orally, and from him then the tradition stemmed down to later generations, generation after generation. And that tradition clarifies the true intention of the verses, and therefore we know the way in which the mitzvahs are supposed to be performed. Now, there's a radical position here. Here's a book. This book is written by God and given to us. What am I supposed to do with it? I don't know. Books have many purposes. You can use them as paperweights. You can use them for juggling. You can read them backwards. Read every fifth letter. Look at the orthography. Maybe it's supposed to be beautiful. I don't know what to do with the book. Read it literally. Read it figuratively. Read it like poetry. Books have very many different purposes. Not only from culture to culture, but within a particular culture, different books and different parts of books have different purposes. The plays of Shakespeare, which are dedicated to historical periods, are not supposed to be the history of the period. You think the play of Shakespeare is telling you the history of the Roman period? It's a mistake. Shakespeare used a historical vehicle to explain truths about human nature. So if the author doesn't tell me what to do with this book, I don't know what to do with it. Now, the author says, here's what I want you to do with it. And he gives a variety of instructions. Each instruction is just as valid as every other instruction. One of the instructions he gives us is to use the 13 rules of Rabbi Shmuel. Kal v'chomer, etc. Rishava, Binyanav. Rules for extracting the laws out of the verses. These rules are not logical. They're not meant to be logical. Some translations of the Siddur, they call them the 13 hermeneutical rules. That's a complete misnomer. Hermeneutics is really commentary, interpretation. These rules do not interpret the text. They are ways of decoding the text to know what God intended us to learn. Now, among all the various ways in which God gave us to decode the text to discover his intention, one of them is the plain, literal meaning of the words. That's one of them. If he hadn't told us that, there would be no reason to pay attention to the literal meaning at all, any more than you do so in Shakespeare. He happened to tell us that's important, so we do indeed pay attention to the literal meanings of the words. But no more so than any other way he told us it's important. Very often I meet people who say, the literal text is what it says, and the rest is homiletics and ingenious plays on words and things to fill your time or maybe to give you moral instruction. But it's not really what the text says. That's completely upside down. I don't care what the text says. I don't care what the text says. Only the author told me that one of his intentions was to communicate to me through what the text says. If he tells me that's good, then it is. And if he doesn't tell me that, then it isn't. And if he tells me there are 13 ways I want to communicate with you, one of which is the literal meaning, and one of which is the homiletical meaning, and one of which is the mystical meaning, and so on and so on, then they're all equally valid. That's why the Ramchal's stress on the word kavanah, intention, is absolutely crucial here. Okay, so now the text he's telling us is one which was written in a certain way that many passages can't be understood unless there's an accompanying explanation. Without that, the verses which command us actions can't be put into practice. I think this is true also for narrative passages. I only started thinking about this recently, but there are narrative passages which raise questions. Any reader, when he reads the story, is going to ask immediately what the statements in the story mean, and there's nothing in the text to give you a clue what the statements mean. Moses is born, and it says his mother saw that he was good, so she hid him for 3 months, and after the 3 months, she couldn't hide him any longer, so she put him in a basket and put him in the river. That's not normal maternal behavior. Okay, so immediately prior, the text says that the Egyptians were looking for newborn male babies to drown them in the river. Fine. So, why was his being good a reason that she could hide him, and otherwise she couldn't hide him? And secondly, why could she only hide him for 3 months? And after 3 months, she couldn't hide him anymore, even though he was good? Any reader is going to ask those questions. Now, how am I supposed to understand this text? The story is written for people to read it. And it's written in such a way that it raises questions that can't be understood on the basis of what's written. So we have to assume is that the reader was in a context where he had access to extra information that made these statements reasonable. Many stories have that feature. Rivka is pregnant, and she has pregnant with twins, although she doesn't know it yet, and the twins are struggling within her, and then she says, it's so, lama ze anochi, which is a kind of existentialist statement, why do I exist? You know, people do suffer distress in childbirth, in pregnancy. I'm sure she wasn't the first person to have distress. And what could have been so terribly distressing that she's questioning her existence? And then God says, you're pregnant with twins, and they're going to struggle with one another, and they're going to fight with one another, and it's going to be like a seesaw. When one is up, the other's down. And then she's satisfied. Why is she satisfied with that? If there isn't extra information as background, it's very difficult to understand how the reader was supposed to relate to this story. So this is the general principle of what Paul said so far, that the text was written in such a way that it's impossible to understand it without the tradition that was handed down with it simultaneously. This means that the external tradition can't be deduced from the text. That's why it is not commentary. The external tradition is not explaining what the text means. If you are on the level of what the text means, you just give up. The text doesn't mean. It doesn't tell us, the commandments don't tell us what to do, and the stories are not self-explanatory. The meaning is inadequate to be a communication. The externally supplied information is what makes it into a full communication, and we get the intention of the author. Now, the second thing he says, I'm not going to translate it, it'll take too long. In the next two pages, you can read it yourselves. Very often in the Talmud, you'll have a law, and the Talmud will say, where do we know this law from? And it will cite a verse. What does the Talmud do? In the Talmud, deducing the law from the verse, is the verse supposed to be a proof that the law is true? Absolutely not. Most of the time, it is not so. Most of the time, the Talmud is associating the law with the verse. You know, when you take an exam, if you have a matching question, you have two lists, you're supposed to match the items, that's much easier than answering the question on your own. All you have to find is the one that's most similar on the list. The list gives you a lot of information, which you wouldn't have had if you had to answer it on your own. Very often, when the Talmud asks, where is the verse for this law? Now I've changed the vocabulary. The verse for this law, not what it's based on, not what it's derived from, not what it's proved from. What it means is, if I have all the verses on this side and all the laws on that side, what is the most similar fit? But that's not a deduction at all. If I didn't have both sides, I never would have dreamt of deducing this law from this verse. So, for example, we have a law that a person, to be executed by the court, must have two witnesses present at the time of the crime, and must be warned that this is a capital crime, and he must respond to the warning, yes, I know, and I'm doing it anyway. For statutory capital punishment, you have to have all of that. Now the Talmud says, what verse is there that's connected with this law? And there's a verse which describes capital punishment with the words, Yovus Hameis, the dead man shall die. And of course the reader said, you know, if he's dead already, he doesn't have to die, right? He's already dead. And the answer is, the person who has freed himself to die, he's allowed himself, he's given himself over to death. So that's the person who shall die, not someone who does not do that. Now, from the words, Yovus Hameis, the dead man shall die, you could not deduce this law in 1,000 years. It's not deducible from that verse. But if I have all the verses on this side, I have all the laws on that side, and I look for the most natural connection, that's the most natural connection as against all the other ones, which are less natural. Now, the Ramchal proves this by analyzing a certain type of logic in the Gemara. Very often in the Gemara, you have a discussion that goes like this. How do we know this law? Law 1. So, an authority will say, Law 1 comes from verse 8. Another authority will say, no, that's not true. Verse A is used for law 2, not for law 1. So then the Talmud will say, well, if so, how does the second authority get law 1? He gets us verse B. They say, oh, if so, then what does the first authority do about the second law? He gets him verse C. Oh, if so, then what does he learn from verse B? Law 4. So then where does he learn law 4 from? Another verse. So then what does he do with that verse? And it goes back and forth like this until finally you come to a closure where one says, I interpret the verse, and the other one says, no, there's nothing there to interpret, so I don't use that verse at all. Or another one says, I can learn two laws out of one verse because I learned the verse a different way. And then everything tallies at the end that each one has a source for every one of the laws that he believes in. Those sources will differ. The modes of attaching them to the verses will differ. Now the question I'm going to ask is this. Why not stop the whole discussion at the first step? This authority learns one from A. This authority learns two from A. Why? Because the second authority doesn't believe in law one. It just doesn't agree. This whole discussion assumes that all the authorities have all the laws in common. And is only questioning how you attach the laws to the verses. Well, that means you're not deducing the laws at all. You're not demonstrating the laws. You're not proving that the laws are correct. Ramchal calls this hints. Much of Jewish scholarship associating the laws with verses are finding hints in the verses to the laws. Nothing more than hints. A student who reads the Talmud and thinks, where is this law from? And a verse is cited and looks at the connection and says, that's not logical. And there's no deduction there. There's no proof there. Says Ramchal, that's right. They weren't looking for a proof. They were looking for an association. This idea goes back to Maimonides in his introduction to the law, the Book of the Commandments. He has 13 introductory principles. At the end of the second principle, he says that it is a desideratum in Jewish scholarship that laws and verses be associated with one another. It's something which the Torah wants us to do as an activity of Jewish scholarship. If someone mistakes those associations for demonstrations, then of course they're going to look very, very peculiar. Okay, that's as far as we get today. Tomorrow, Mr. Shemar, we'll finish this section.